This week, my interview with the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, on the South Africa-Russia weapons row, the conflict in Sudan, and aid to the Horn of Africa. Also, will ties between the U.S. and African countries be tested at the UN in coming months? Plus, Uganda's president signs off on one of the world's toughest anti-gay laws. What does this mean for the LGBTQ rights movement? And how worried should activists be about a domino effect across the African continent? Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. I'm Heidi Adams. My guest this week is U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. I spoke to her earlier about the conflict in Sudan, the South Africa-Russia arms controversy, and whether she thinks ties between the U.S. and African nations will be tested at the United Nations in coming months. Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield spoke to me from VOA studios at the United Nations. You announced in recent days around $524 million in drought aid for the Horn of Africa. U.S. aid to the region for 2023 now stands at around $1.4 billion. Ma'am, is that enough? I mean, how far does and can this money go towards addressing what you have called a storm of crises that has pushed millions across the Horn of Africa to the brink?
Haiti, it is not enough. The UN has asked for $7 billion. So what you heard announced is just a small contribution toward addressing a major global issue, and that is hunger. It is famine in the Horn of Africa. Our $524 million was a huge contribution. It's the largest contribution. It brings our total for the fiscal year to about $2.5 billion, but more is needed. I visited Somalia earlier in the year and made a strong appeal to the rest of the world that they should be assisting in this situation. Children should not starve to death. People should not go to bed hungry. We have the resources to address this issue. We just have to come to the table and bring the needed resources to those people in need. And I think we can do more.
Ma'am, I want to turn to the South Africa-Russia weapons controversy that has taken place in recent weeks. How would you describe the relationship between South Africa and the United States at the moment? I mean, are there limits to this relationship?
Look, we have a strong historical relationship with South Africa, and that relationship is going to continue based on the priorities of the American people and of the South African people. We will continue to find ways to work with each other to bring those priorities to the table, whether it's trade, development assistance, it's finding pathways for America and South Africa to continue to have conversations on the things that we are prioritizing in our relationship.
Ma'am, South Africa has taken, of course, what it calls a non-aligned stance when it comes to Russia's war in Ukraine. In your view, is South Africa acting like a country that is taking a non-aligned stance in this war?
Look, we've also been very clear on this issue as well, Haiti. There's no neutrality when a member of the P5 attack a smaller nation, as Russia has done, an unprovoked aggression against Ukraine. You can't be you can't be neutral on that. This is a violation of everything that the UN Charter stands for. And we've made that point clear to all of our partners who have made taken the stance of neutrality when it comes to what is clearly an aggression, which is against the sovereignty and the integrity of a border of an independent country.
Ma'am, what will the United States do if Vladimir Putin shows up in South Africa for the BRICS conference?
You know, I think that question should be, what will South Africa do if Putin shows up? South Africa has obligations under international agreements, under the ICC, to turn over an individual who has been convicted. So the question should be to South Africa. We hope South Africa will do the right thing.
Are sanctions, do you rule out sanctions at any point? You once said that countries complain about sanctions because they work. Do you foresee sanctions on the horizon should South Africa host Vladimir Putin?
We're not going to get into our private conversations with the South African government, but we have made clear that there are obligations that we hope and expect that South Africa will honor.
Ma'am, as you lead the U.S. delegation to the second session of the U.N. Permanent Forum of Peoples of African Descent, I want to talk a little bit about U.S.-Africa relations at the United Nations. Do you anticipate in coming months any opportunities to strengthen U.S.-Africa relations? And do you anticipate those relations, those ties will be tested, especially at the U.N. in coming months?
You know, that is an extraordinarily important question that you ask, Haiti. We work every day to strengthen our relationship with the continent of Africa. For me personally, it is a strong commitment. As you know, I spent most of my career on the African continent. I spend the vast majority of my time meeting with the 54 African member states on a regular basis. There is an A3, the elected members of the Security Council. I engage with them on a regular basis. And our government is strongly committed to continuing to really build on what is already a strong partnership with the African continent. We are the largest donor to countries in Africa, to humanitarian programs, development programs. We are a big trade partner on the continent of Africa, and we want to continue to nourish those relationships both here in New York, but also on the continent.
Ma'am, the Africans have for the longest time called for more a permanent role at the UN Security Council. Is there any progress that has been made on that front?
That's something that we're working on every single day. You may recall that last year in September, I gave a speech in San Francisco in which I indicated that we were supportive of African countries and others. We were supportive of UN reform to include more permanent members as well as elected members. The president went further in his speech in September and specifically said that we would support permanent membership for Africa, Latin America, as well as the Caribbean. Since then, I have engaged in a listening tour. I've met with the C10, the 10 African countries that are engaged on UN reform. I've met individually with African countries as well as other regions to talk about how we might implement and really instrumentalize this this commitment to the continent, to UN reform. And this is something that we're continuing to work on. But we have been clear throughout this that we do support permanent membership for Africa on the Security Council for a country from Africa.
Ma'am, finally, I want to move to the conflict in Sudan. That country's army chief, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has asked the UN to replace its special envoy to that country, Volker Perthes. What does this mean for U.S. and U.S. and UN efforts to help bring an end to the conflict in Sudan? I mean, what influence, what diplomatic tools do the UN and the U.S. now have at their disposal to help bring an end to the conflict?
Well, as you know, we have been actively engaged since day one in trying to find a solution. The U.S. government, working with the Saudi government, has held a number of meetings in Jeddah that got the two sides to agree to a ceasefire, to allow for humanitarian assistance. It's still a work in progress. And as the U.S. and Saudi Arabia continue to work on this, we are very supportive of those efforts here at the United Nations. We have had a number of meetings in the Security Council on the situation in Sudan. We support the African Union and IGAD efforts, these regional efforts, and we will keep putting pressure on the two sides to move toward a ceasefire that will allow for a civilian-run government. And that is something that I think has support across the board, both on the continent of Africa, but also here at the United Nations.
All right, we're going to leave it there. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Madam, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. Well, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa. Uganda now has one of the world's toughest anti-gay legislation. Should rights activists be worried about a domino effect across the continent? We'll discuss that after the break. Don't go away. Straight Talk Africa, welcome back. An answer to the cries of our people. That is what Uganda's parliament calls its controversial Anti-Homosexuality Act, which was signed by President Yoweri Museveni on Monday. It's one of the world's toughest anti-gay laws and calls for life imprisonment for anyone convicted of homosexuality. The law, supported by many in the East African nation, has been condemned by rights activists and others abroad, including the White House. U.S. President Joe Biden calls the law shameful, warning his government could impose sanctions. Meanwhile, rights groups worry Uganda's anti-gay laws could have a domino effect across the continent. VOA's Ignatius Annell has more.
Living openly as a trans woman has closed a lot of doors for me. It has taken a lot of things away from me. It has taken people away from me. I cannot live my life as a normal human being or as a normal Ghanaian who can walk freely on the streets, who can, you know, partake in every other thing that any other Ghanaian can partake in. I can't go out to look for a job because nobody wants to employ me.
That was Angel Maxim, Ghana's first open trans position, telling VOA about the effect of Ghana's anti-gay bill, which currently sits before Parliament. Maxim says what the bill, formerly known as the Promotion of Proper Human Sexual Rights and Ghanaian Family Values Bill, is yet to pass the legislature, its adverse impact is being felt among sexual minorities in Ghana. The bill will impose up to 10 years prison sentence on anyone who identifies as LGBTQI+, or even an ally. Amnesty International defines an ally as one who takes action to support a group they are not part of.
The bill that we're sponsoring is one that is responding to the growing threat to Ghana's culture and traditions by pro-Western forces and influences seeking to introduce things that are not acceptable by our culture. And until the people I represent in Parliament ask me not to, it's a bill I intend to see through to the end.
In Africa today, 32 states still criminalize same-sex relationships. That's half of the 64 countries with anti-gay laws around the world. Some, like Nigeria and Egypt, already have harsh laws making LGBTQI+ persons a target in their communities, activists say.
President Yoweri Museveni on Friday, May the 26th, signed one of the harshest gay laws in the world, defying global outrage and potential sanctions. Now the Anti-Homosexuality Act, it has the death penalty for engaging in incest, having sex with a minor, or carrying the HIV virus. Activists have vowed a legal challenge. Richard Lusimbo is the Director General of Uganda Key Populations Consortium, a Kampala-based NGO.
The Constitution of Uganda is very clear on the rights of all Ugandans, and it's on this basis that we will be going to the Constitutional Court to seek legal redress, because when you look at the right to health, the right to belong, if you look at even employment, because again, within this law, if you are identified as an LGBT person, that could have lots of negative implications in terms of even how you can access work.
Both Uganda and Ghana have closed LGBTQI plus organizations known as safe spaces that support the mental health of community members. Their contentions in Kenya and Tanzania over LGBTQI plus rights.
I am an artist. I'm a very good one, a very good, talented artist. But nobody will want to collaborate or want to work or want to support or want to put in, you know, into what I do just because I am a queer person.
This month, Speaker of Uganda's Parliament, Anita Among, called on the East African community to support other member states to fight what she termed, quote, immoral act in the community, end of quote, at a virtual meeting with her colleagues.
To identify with us in whatever we had done in order to protect the morals, the values, and the generations to come.
As such anti-gay sentiments rise, activists continue working to affirm the human rights of LGBTQI plus persons in Africa.
We've also been using our proximity to the United Nations. As I've spoken to you now about the Advocacy Week that we've hosted, we are part of the UN LGBTIQ core group, where we have access to politicians and diplomats there who can help us open paths for dialogue with lawmakers in countries where we are concerned about the LGBTQ community members' safety.
But not all is gloomy for the LGBTQI plus community or for allies. There have been efforts by some African states to roll back harsh laws against homosexuality, notably Angola, Botswana, and Gabon, which reversed a law to criminalize homosexuality but made gay sex punishable by spending 6 months in jail and a huge fine. Ignatius Ano, VOA News, Washington.
Joining me to discuss this is Livingston Sewanyana. He's the founder and executive director of the Foundation for Human Rights Initiative, a Ugandan civil society organization. He's also an advocate of the High Court of Uganda. And he joins me from Kampala in that country. Also with us is Erin Kilbride from Human Rights Watch. Erin is a researcher on LGBTQ rights. She joins us from Miami, Florida. Erin and Livingston, a warm welcome to both of you. And I want to put the first question to you, Livingston. One of the criticisms of Uganda's Anti-Homosexuality Act is that it is harsh. Now, when you hear words like life in prison, the death penalty, you know, it's almost understandable why people would think this is harsh. Why is this law coming across as so harsh? What kind of trends or statistics or studies are authorities looking at that would warrant such a response?
Here in Uganda, like in most countries in Africa, homosexuality is perceived as an existential threat to African family values, beliefs, and religious teachings. And for a long time, such activities have been proscribed. Uganda is now has a law which is being passed for the second time. This is not the first time this act has been passed. We had a similar act, but it was overturned by the Constitutional Court. What makes this act more harsher and more stiffer is the fear of promotion. This law seeks to avert the growing influence of homosexuality in the country. It has been discussed in very many circles that apparently children are being infiltrated, schools are being infiltrated, and that there is a heavy investment in that regard to promote homosexuality. That is why this act is much stiffer than maybe other existing legislations that we have had. The opportunity we have, however, is that, like in the previous case, it has been petitioned against the Constitutional Court. We believe the merits of this particular law will be determined by the Constitutional Court appropriately.
Just a question here, Livingston. When it comes to, we hear a lot of talk about protecting children from people who are gay, who might want to, abuse children. Are laws equally harsh and stiff around straight men or straight people who are found guilty of abusing children?
We have existing legislation that seeks to punish such behavior. However, that the existing legislation is not as strict as the Anti-Homosexuality Act. That's why the legislator this time thought it appropriate to address all the different elements. What we are, however, very much opposed to is the provision for the death penalty. We don't believe in the death penalty, and we think that this is an opportunity also for the Constitutional Court to make a firm pronouncement on the question of the death penalty, whether in respect of homosexuals or in respect of other capital offenses.
Aaron, this of course puts two African countries, South Africa and Uganda, now at near polar opposite sides when it comes to gay rights. South Africa was the very first country, of course, in the world to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. It does legalize same-sex marriages. What have you found are the factors that would make two countries go in these very different directions?
Hi, thank you for having me. I think, to be honest, the first thing I would respond to was just this idea of any two countries being polar opposites on the idea of LGBT rights. I'm sitting in Miami, Florida right now, which has become sort of the epicenter of attacks on LGBT families and LGBT rights in the United States. So while we do have, for example, a State Department that put out a statement condemning this new act in Uganda, as it should have done, the idea that any two countries can be sort of diametrically opposed to one another in the promotion and protection of LGBT people, I think, is a bit more complicated than that. And this law has also been spoken about quite a bit as supported by many in Uganda and condemned by many abroad. And I think this dichotomy between local support and foreign opposition is not only harmful, it's actually false. It's a false dichotomy. It ignores the many parts of Ugandan society which are deeply opposed to these very harsh penalties, to introducing the death penalty for aggravated homosexuality, as it's referred to. It ignores the work of human rights defenders supporting people in access to health and education and housing, many of whom you just interviewed just before Livingston and I spoke. And it also ignores international and regional treaties that Uganda has ratified, such as the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, which has specific resolutions that protect LGBT people. So I think that framing is very important. You asked specifically about South Africa. And I mean, again, these are very different countries with very different histories who are grappling with this human rights issue in their legislatures at different moments in those political histories. So in South Africa, one key political point to think about is a sort of post-apartheid consensus that there should be no discrimination on the basis of natural characteristics. So that post-apartheid context is really deeply important. But again, what this looks like in different countries is really sort of unique to what that country is experiencing in the moment. But I think it's very important to highlight the work of civil society in each of these countries to fight against this kind of repression.
Livingston, given what has happened now in Uganda, are we likely to see more countries on the continent likely more to follow South Africa's example or Uganda's example? What are you seeing?
Yes, I first see many countries following in the footsteps of Uganda's approach, depending on the nature of society and their history. For example, if you look at South Africa and Uganda, South Africa is more liberal. It's a more liberal society. Uganda is a more conservative society. And as such, they take a stronger approach to criminality or to acts that are not in tandem with the population, the aspirations and their beliefs and values. I see more countries, for example, Eswatini will fall suit. Countries like Burundi are likely to fall suit. Ivory Coast are likely to fall suit because ideally they already criminalize same-sex marriages and they think this would be a good example. So it is a threat in one way or the other. But on the other hand, it also speaks volumes about a particular country's political culture, its history, its beliefs, and also the way society has organized itself. For example, the Ugandan society is largely Christian, and as such, they believe the Bible does not agree with this homosexuality. And for example, the church has been one of the most outspoken and ardent supporters of the fight against homosexuality. So depending on the nature of the society in whichever country we are talking about, they might either follow the South African path or the Ugandan path.
Even though the church is often criticized as well for being a Western concept or a Western idea as well, Aaron, how hard is it to actually enforce anti-gay rights legislation, especially the kind that we see in Uganda? Do you know of any examples from countries in other parts of the world that actually have successfully enforced these kinds of laws?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that question. I think one of the most important things to think about here is what we mean by anti-gay legislation. So typically that is understood to mean laws which criminalize same-sex conduct or perhaps colonial era legislation, which would very often criminalize or be sort of an anti-sodomy law, right? And this looks very different in different parts of the world, but anti-LGBT legislation has the potential to impact nearly every part of a person's life because it creates a context in which their lives, their love, their ways of organizing, their activist collectives and their families are seen, as Livingston was saying, as diametrically opposed to the way the nation is supposed to function. And so this leads not only to arrest, detention, imprisonment, and all of the accompanying abuses in terms of direct persecution by the state, but also discrimination in access to healthcare, social services, housing, education, childcare, banking. As I was saying, I'm sitting in Florida, and we've heard repeatedly over the past few days reports from queer communities here that folks who can afford to leave the state because they're fearful for the lives of and the education of their trans children, of their queer children, are leaving. Those who can't can afford to do so. But I think what's important, as I was saying, to consider is what we mean by anti-gay laws, because this doesn't just include the very harsh criminalization and the penalties that we're seeing Uganda introduce for same-sex conduct. It also includes things that impact other parts of people's lives. In February, Human Rights Watch released a 26-country investigation, because you were asking about what this looks like at a global level. We released a 26-country investigation looking at violence and discrimination against lesbian, bisexual, and queer women and non-binary people in particular, which really looked beyond that criminalization, right? And it looked at how other forms of sexist and patriarchal legal regimes, like male guardianship, like unequal inheritance, can a sister inherit land on equal terms with a brother, right? How do these types of discrimination against women and single women impact LGBTQ women's abilities to live their lives? So in addition to physical and sexual violence from security forces, from these sort of laws on the books, we also have to look at other types of discrimination that people are facing at work, in land and property rights, in access to building and protecting their families, in migration.
Livingston Sewanyana and Aaron Kilbride, I wish we had more time, had more questions for you, but we'll speak to you again at a future date. Thank you so much for your time and your insights. And that was our show this week. Thank you for joining us on television, radio, and online, and I will see you next time. Goodbye.